Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before. Every year there's been less clean air than there was the year before that.
Every year. Welcome to Nature Best Last in the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This is December 29th, 2015 edition, episode 70 of Nature Bats Last, comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico. That's where Guy is broadcasting this weekend, Phoenix, Arizona, where I find myself. Our thanks again to Afrozen for his incredible theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. Last week, we were joined by Mark Austin, a former student of Guy's, and he's a whistleblower who spent 14 years as a contractor with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Needless to say, his comments blew us away. This episode, thus far, has had almost 5,200 listens, and it is triple our average. That episode was popular, to say the least. This week, however, we moderate a discussion with all of you about last week's interview and the larger issues it raises. We'd especially like to focus on those larger issues, including the surveillance activity and misinformation within police state America and by extension throughout the global north. Please give us a call toll free, 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888 if you would like to comment and discuss. God.
Immediately after last week's show, a person from the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area contacted me. He wanted to talk. We spoke via Skype on Sunday, 2 days ago. I'll call him Thomas. For those of you with biblical tendencies, that gives this story a Mark and a Thomas. The latter is a skeptic. You can call him Doubting Thomas. I'll just call him Thomas. Thomas, like Mark, is a former federal contractor. He claims Mark's story is an attempt to discredit me and my message about near-term human extinction as a result of abrupt climate change. We had quite the long and rambling conversation. Thomas looks a lot like me. He's white, relatively wealthy, and in his mid-50s. He has views that resemble those of a lot of people who look like me. For example, he believes John F. Kennedy was killed by a single bullet that came from the gun of Lee Harvey Oswald. I failed to ask him about the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Perhaps some of our listeners know that the United States federal government was found guilty of killing King in a court of law in this country. But I doubt if Thomas knows that. Thomas mentioned that nobody in government questions anthropogenic climate change. I asked him about James Imhoff, the United States senator from Oklahoma. Thomas hadn't heard of him. Let's let that sink in for a minute. When I reminded him about Imhoff throwing snowballs on the Senate floor, he remembered, and he said the legislative branch is not part of the government. They have no power. They simply don't matter. This was news to me. I thought we had a tripartite form of government in this country, but Thomas says there's no power in the legislative branch. Thomas also believes the official narrative of 9/11. He became uncharacteristically quiet when I asked about Building 7. He claimed that the Twin Towers burned so hot enough to melt steel beams because they contain so much plastic. I asked him the temperature at which plastic burns. He didn't know, so I looked it up. Plastic burns at no more than 1,035 degrees Fahrenheit. considerably cooler than the 2,750 degrees Fahrenheit needed to melt steel beams. I suspect somebody here isn't providing the whole story. Somebody here is a disinformation agent. I can't tell whether it's Mark or Thomas. Maybe it's both. I'll provide a very brief synopsis of Mark's response to me in light of my conversation with Thomas. I'll not give details for reasons that will become clear. Here's the four-line synopsis. Mark asked me to drop this issue for safety reasons. He suggested that we reveal on today's show that he's a complete idiot, and it indicated that this whole affair is worse than we can imagine. Out of respect for Mark, I'll no longer quote him, and I'll try to avoid mentioning him at all.
This issue does raise several questions for us, and we can address them with this show. You know, and listeners, please prepare comments and questions in light of these questions we are asking ourselves. One, why would someone with a belief system such as Thomas care if you, Guy, are being discredited? Two, how does Thomas think you are being discredited by Mark's statements? Three, what's the intent or motivation of Thomas or Mark? Four, what can anyone do with this information? And five, how does this impact our work?
On a related note, I'm in the midst of writing an essay for the blog. I'll post the final version within a few days. Currently, it's scheduled to go up tomorrow at guymcpherson.com. I'll include the following information. Except as pawns in the infinite growth paradigm, you and I don't matter to the people in power. We are cannon fodder, useful only to further the power of others and used primarily to that end. Do you not understand why the most lethal group of people in the history of the world might not be interested in pursuing peace? Who do you think benefits from a fearful populace? Who do you think benefits from military action? Imagine as just one example a depopulation scenario involving all or nearly all inhabitants of North America. Horrifying, you say, and therefore implausible. Or is it? It's implausible to those who believe the official narrative put out by the corporate government and its corporate press. And here I should mention that Thomas is a journalist. But if you believe the official narrative from, for example, Pearl Harbor, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, or the events of September 11, 2001, then I suspect you're the type of drone the corporations love. You may as well return to your television instead of reading the remainder of this essay. Here's what the United States government knew about abrupt climate change in 2003, based on a document I used in teaching courses for several years after it was published. Quote, as famine, disease, and weather-related disasters strike due to the abrupt climate change, many countries' needs will exceed their carrying capacity. This will create a sense of desperation, which is likely to lead to offensive aggression in order to reclaim balance. I'll include links to all information in the essay at the blog that will be posted within the next few days. To continue, we know, based on a secret 1948 report on covert biowarfare, that the United States, quote, is particularly vulnerable, end quote, to covert germ attack because enemy agents, quote, are present already in this country, and there is no control exercised over the movements of people, end quote. Although this report emphasized the threat to America, the report called for offensive capability. Quote, biological agents would appear to be well adapted to subversive use, since very small amounts of such agents can be effective. A significant portion of the human population within selected target areas may be killed or incapacitated, end quote. Remember, this was 1948, the same year George Orwell wrote 1984, although the latter was published in 1949. To return to the essay, we also know that the United States government planned, quote, a wholesale slaughter of much of the planet's population. That was 1956. And the proposed killer tech was nuclear weapons. They were aimed at the Soviet Union, but there's no reason to believe contemporary leaders value Americans more than any other consumers. We also know, based on a report from December 27th, 2015, which is not very long ago if you're keeping track, quote, a U.S. military defense laboratory at Dugway Proving Grounds mailed anthrax to South Korea at least 15 times prior to the previously acknowledged March 2015 delivery. End quote. South Korea is allegedly one of our allies. The government lied about mailing anthrax and at least one other biological weapon to South Korea. We know the system teeters on the brink. We know industrial civilization benefits a few humans at the expense of many humans and non-human life on Earth. Available evidence indicates habitat for humans will be eliminated when the House of Cards finally falls. If those pulling the strings of empire know what we know, why would they not attempt to eliminate a large proportion of the human population on this continent? Ethics? Surely you jest. Let's take this scenario a step further along the path of the Four Horsemen. The proverbial powers that be know what we know, and a lot more. They will be able to determine faster than you and me when collapse has been triggered. Rather than allowing events to play out by themselves, hence allowing a vast majority of the people on the continent to die soon thereafter from dehydration, starvation, and suicide, perhaps these wealthy CEOs would prefer to kill a lot of people directly and swiftly to preserve a few spots for themselves. Ultimately, they'll die, of course. Ultimately, the nuclear facilities will melt down, and the dust will choke their lungs, and the food will run out, and the wells will run dry. But these are the kind of people who are willing to spend squillions, and thanks to our friend Paul Marcotte for that word, to survive a few days longer. These are the kind of people who knowingly wound and kill dozens of other people for a few extra digits in the bank account. These are the people whose sense of entitlement exceeds their sense of fairness. They'll take without giving. They'll kill without compunction. Why would they not? They know the consequences of their behavior. They know already that others die so that they can live richly. Taking a few more steps along the path of fugigum is instinctual. It's how they arrived at their lofty positions within civilization.
Fugigum? What's fugigum?
Well, thanks for asking. That's an old acronym for fuck you, Jack. I've got mine. It's the mentality of lots of privileged people in the global north. Lest you believe they're worried about the catastrophic meltdown of nuclear facilities, fear not. Death via lethal mutations will require a generation or two, maybe more, to fully manifest. These people are motivated to persist a few more months or a few more years. They're not particularly concerned about future generations. After all, they've already killed their own children. This scenario requires only general awareness, a few facts, and elementary logic. As a result, it's well beyond the comprehension of the typical American.
Amen. Again, if you want to talk to us and discuss the show and what Guy has just said and some of the questions we've posed, you can call us at toll-free 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. And we have Ray from Florida on the line. Ray, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Guy and Mike. About your presentation in July of 2015, Guy, that you just posted a few days ago at your website. I've been following your work, and I know you choose your words very carefully, and it really stood out to me that you made a declarative statement in that July presentation of yours that you said Fukushima is an extinction-level event, whereas prior to that you had said, you know, it's a really bad idea, of course it's awful, and I was wondering what information had come to you that made you make such a declarative statement.
I have read more about that event and have read more of the work of Helen Caldicott and Arne Gundersen. And previously, I hadn't delved as deeply as I could have into that issue. Now that I have, there's little doubt in my mind that when the events play out over a couple or three or four or six generations, we're done for. Thanks for the question.
Okay, any more?
Okay, goodbye.
Okay, let's go to Jeff from Philadelphia. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, guys? How you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good. Talk to you guys a little bit on Facebook, but I've been taking a Facebook break. Great show last week. It really kind of hit me on the same level as when I first actually saw Guys Going Dark on YouTube about a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. So it was just, you know, really well done, a lot of good information, and, you know, just kind of came at it from a different angle than what we're used to. You know, it's like a little more kind of from inside the system. I thought it was really interesting, and Mark had a lot of points that I thought kind of lined up with what we say, but just kind of like from a little more, like I said, in the system. And you know, it's kind of, someone once said, when Democrats and Republicans say the same thing, you should get a little scared. And in this case, I guess it's like you know, and people in the Mud Hut and people from the Pentagon are saying the same thing. You might want to pay attention.
Yeah, thanks for the comment. Do you have a question, Jeff?
Hello?
Jeff, do you have a question for us?
Yeah. Well, I guess kind of actually going off to sorry, I lost the phone connection there for a second, but going off of what Mike said kind of in the beginning, you know, I thought his statement with Cop Out 21 was quite interesting. And, well, I guess kind of my question is, you know, like, you know, it's just an interesting seeing you guys kind of grow throughout the show for the last, you know, year and a half or whatever. I guess really what I'm getting at is, like, you know, hearing Mike's statement about kind of seeing elements of previous shows, I feel like, in that statement with kind of like the rewilderness and kind of the whole idea of self and other. It's just like, and also with you guys being teachers, and I've taught a little bit myself, you know, if this was Earth giving the test back to us and we're the students, you know, what kind of grade will we get? Maybe put a number on it, or I don't know, 10% or 20%. And also, just like, what questions do we clearly get wrong? What questions do we get partially wrong? And maybe there's one or two questions that we kind of got right, but it doesn't matter because it kind of gets washed out in the noise.
Absolutely. I think I'm careful when I say we, because it's really, and Guy and I always emphasize this, it's really the dominant culture that is getting the questions wrong. I don't know if you would agree with that, Guy.
Right.
I absolutely
agree with that. It is absolutely the dominant culture. It's not all human beings on the planet. You know, for the first 2.8 million years of the genus Homo, we didn't come up with something resembling the dominant culture. We didn't come up with civilization in any form. That's a relatively recent phenomenon within the last few thousand years, in fact. And that's where the problem arises. So I'm careful about using we and restricting it to the civilized. And most notably, the civilization dominated by people who look a lot like us, Mike.
A white guys with some massive privilege. For me, I mean, you know, in light of last week, you know, because it took, like everybody else, it kind of exploded, and there was a lot of chatter going back and forth, and it took people by surprise, and it took me a few days to really digest what was being said. But then once I got back to really thinking about the predicament we're in, for me, it actually changes very little of how I live my life currently. Now that I live my life really kind of what I would consider outside the traditional status quo, and even in light of what was said last week, I think I've made what I consider to be necessary changes in my life to thrive despite the insanity that surrounds us. And I think it's not necessarily because I'm smart enough or I was smart enough to see what was happening, hardly. Instead, I think it's I've just kind of looked at the big picture, and I have the privilege of being able to take advantage of my circumstances and the fuck it attitude, as we say, to kind of move outside of my comfort zone and one step beyond, and simply just wallowing in, you know, the clusterfuck that is our living arrangement and wasting my days fretting over what I cannot control is, for me, it's unacceptable. So what I can control are my actions and my, you know, my subsequent decisions, I guess. And what is acceptable to me is being well-informed while trying to balance all the toxic information that we receive and, you know, and kind of balance that with ultimately what makes me happy. And so I really have tried to really build the relationships and the people that surround me and improve upon that. And I, you know, I just kind of let the rest kind of take care of itself, so to speak. So,
we certainly have earned a failing grade. Civilization in general, the civilized among us have failed future generations and arguably the current generation. So what if we're going to pick that apart into individual pieces and where and how we failed in various places, well, we could play that game for a long time. Yeah. You know, at some level, the sociopaths assume control when you have more than Dunbar's number of people in the group, in the tribe or the band. And that's where we're at, is a bunch of nations led by or headed by sociopaths.
Right.
And, you know, we lost power a long time ago with respect to who really pulls the strings of imperialism. So I don't think there's any going back. And that's really the root of the myriad predicaments we face is sociopathy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think last week's conversation just really emphasized that a little more. And maybe people kind of were overlooking that a little more and instead looking at the impacts of such leadership instead of the actual leadership and what those folks, you know, who they truly are.
Right. We have another caller. We have Matt from Florida. Matt, are you still with us?
I'm still with you, Guy. Hi, Mike. How you doing?
Hey, great.
I was blown away by the unnamed person from last week's presentation. I was excited about the opportunity to hear what I was expecting to be a whistleblower. But what I heard and how he presented himself, and if you'll note in the last 5 minutes of his talk, he was, you know, talking about his great connection with Hollywood and how he worked for, Lucasfilm, and he was name dropping all of these kind of media connections. And that really tipped me off because it sounded to me that he was trying to present himself as a new media stream. And if he was going to present himself as a new media stream, and if he isn't, quote unquote, working for, you know, the government, then the question comes up is who would he be working for? And we don't have to go too far in the alternative news industry to hear James Corbett of the Corbett Report or Alex Jones. And we hear these people with incredible, a long list of progressive and somewhat revolutionary messages. But both of them are notable in that they are huge deniers of the climate. And if we look at the whole pantheon of so many popular alternative news resources and we go through their list of issues, for some reason, a number of them seem to be climate deniers as well. And this process is probable. And the question becomes is who would hire them and who would pay them? And Edward Snowden, is that his name, Ed Snowden? Snowden, the whistleblower, is it Edward? I don't know if his first name is Edward. But Snowden is a classic example of somebody who we don't really ask who he works for. We know that he's a whistleblower, but when we find out he works for a company and that company is well paid by taxpayer money, and then we see that his information is actually coming so much from the public domain and it's vetted through so many official channels that his whistleblowing sounds a lot like disinformation. And when we listen to the man like the unnamed person from last week, it sounded to me that his goal was to present his company, the company that he works for, on the taxpayer's dole to misinform us with more crap and to throw more information into the wheel and possibly gain some traction against what I believe Guy McPherson to be, which is the first honest 100% truth teller who's willing to get on the radio and tell people without a company behind him, without a corporation behind him, without a government behind him, and without any sort of motivation other than his pursuit of the truth to tell the American people what's really going on with the climate. So that is the target A number one for anybody who's in the disinfo business. And you have to look only so far to find out who's behind these huge disinfo operations it takes a quick Google search to come up with names like Booz Allen and Stratifor, and to find out what kind of money comes down the pipeline from the oil industrial complex through people like the Koch brothers. But I don't know, because you can never prove these things. You can't go into the background of these people and find out where it's actually coming from. So you can only glean that information from their actions. And the unnamed person from last week appeared to be just that type of person.
Matt, thanks for your question. We'll take it with you off the air if you don't mind. Ultimately, of course, we don't know. Mark was extremely nervous during his interview, probably in large part for two reasons. One, it was the first interview he's ever conducted. And two, he was presenting some pretty significant information. I should point out that he was at the same level of government as Edward Snowden. They're both government contractors contracted by an agency in the U.S. federal government. Almost all the information Mark Austin presented can be easily fact-checked with publicly available information. So it's not as if there are unknowns regarding the United States and its biowarfare program, although they couch it as an experimental program, and every time they kill people in this country or beyond, they call it an experiment rather than a project. So there are things we don't know, obviously, and that's what we're trying to get to, is those unknowns for us. Were we completely successful? No. But there are people who are afraid for their lives and for the lives of their family members as a result of last week's show. I think maybe we touched a nerve.
Yeah, I think if it is disinformation, it certainly worked on some levels, because it worked up a lather in many of us. And he said something interesting in the interview that I sort of kind of had a little bit of a And I don't know. I haven't looked at I'll have to go back and look at the transcript that Pauline put together. But I think he mentioned something about reading your blog, you know, and he's gone back and he's read from the beginning and he's, you know, gone through the comments and things like that. And then he said something to the effect that he was wondering what he could bring that was new to the conversation. And I just thought that was an interesting comment. And it sort of made me think about maybe a little more about, you know, intent. And so we can talk about that if people have questions. Our next caller is Claude from New York City. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. Hi. I had a question. I wanted to ask you, concerning climate change, at about what age, at what grade level would you see trying to introduce this information? Because I've read, Guy, a lot of your books, and I've listened to your comments about this being a time, you know, it can't be a time of denial, but it's really a time for living, for having a fantastic life, or whatever we have left, for time we have left. And young people, I think today, if they were given this information, would they be able to do any? Would they be able to change, you know, how we live? You know, they could be, for instance, you know, we should be spending less money on military military weaponry and research, and more money on perhaps if there possibly would be a way of changing this climate situation, of energy sources and so forth and so on. That was one issue I wanted to bring up. Commenting on Mark Austin's interview last week, a lot of what the government probably does is they just play what if games. You know, what if we did this? What if we did that? What would happen? And I don't know. I'll listen again. A lot of what he said didn't really surprise me at all. And also, do you have any other way of communicating besides social media? Outside of the showtime, because I don't participate with social media, and I was wondering if you answer your email.
Yeah, good questions. Yes, I answer my email. It consumes a large majority of my time every day. So if you send me an email message, I will almost certainly respond, unless it's hate mail. Sometimes I respond to those just for fun.
Only from me, though.
But not all the time. And so I'll almost certainly respond. All my contact information is at guymcpherson.com at the blog, so you can find me there. With respect to climate change and how early in their lives we should introduce information to people, I think this applies to any age. I'm not sure how to present evidence to people who are 5 years old and 8 years old and 12 years old and so on. But I've never been a big fan of continuing the myth of Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and the invisible white man in the sky to youngsters. And so I think the same applies at the level of scientific information as well. Mike, did you want to comment on that?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, maybe in some aspects, without the science at all, talking to kids about this, when they start to be introduced to the concept of death itself. And not having children, I don't know exactly when that happens, but...
Right. As I understand it, by the time kids are five or so, they understand death and human death, and they integrate it as part of their own lives. They realize it's going to happen to them, too, right, by the time they're 10 or 12. But I suspect there's quite a bit of variation there, too.
Yeah. And, you know, I keep going back to our guest, you know, earlier in early September, Stephen Jenkinson, and he, you know, he speaks about how we try and shield children from death. And obviously that just carries over into our adult lives, and the narrative continues that we, you know, death happens to other folks, it happens to the other, and it doesn't happen to us. And I think breaking, I don't know if it's breaking the news, but necessarily introducing, you know, the predicament in some level, and maybe like your children's book, would be a way to do that in a context that they would understand.
Yeah, but I should point out here that you're asking two white men in the global north who don't have children. So maybe we're not the best people to comment about it. Maybe every now and then we should take our own advice and shut up and listen. You're listening to Nature Bites Last on the Progressive Radio Network. This is a call-in show. Give us your calls, please, at 888-874-4888. I think we have Sherry on the line. Sherry, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Hi. I'm very thankful that you are there and very grateful for your courage and both of your courage as well as your speaker last week. I think it, even if just a small portion of what he said is true, the courage he had to speak out and even during fear, that's a hard thing to do for anybody, but I think we have abundant evidence for everything that you say. But my question really doesn't have to do with our speaker or anything. I'm just flummoxed by this nonchalant reporting of this historic flood in the Mississippi River, and that's coming, and that it might be a record-breaking flood. So I went to Wikipedia to see when all the historic floods that we know of were in the Mississippi. All except for one happened between April and October. So they were, you know, to have this much water coming down the Mississippi the end of December, of course, is another red flag to add to all the other ones. But I wondered if you had any comments about that.
No, that's a good point. You make a good point, and that is that, in my experience anyway, almost everybody needs a personal story. They need their own life and their own observations to reach the conclusion that we are in the midst of abrupt climate change. So you can read about it all day, you can hear about it on the radio all day, but until it hits you and your neighborhood and you make those direct observations, it seems pretty abstract and maybe even ethereal. And so yours is a good point. Many of the skeptics about climate change will, of course, attribute this to El Nino. They will point out that there has been little warming, what they call no warming, since 1997-98, which is the last time we had a big El Nino event. And that's incorrect. There's been considerable warming since then. But then they'll turn right around and say that the current warming and the current weather events are a result of the El Nino that's going on right now, which, according to NOAA, is the biggest El Nino event in human history, at least. Now, with respect to the individual events, it's pretty difficult to assign to any particular event the cause climate change or anthropogenic climate change or abrupt climate change. But we're seeing a lot more of those, aren't we? I mean, since Katrina, how many superstorms have we had? At least two come to mind for me. There's Sandy that struck the northeastern coast of the United States and Haiyan that hit the Philippines just a year or two later. So we're seeing the rapid increase of these kinds of events. Can any one of them be attributed to anthropogenic climate change? Well, that might be a step too far. But the fact that we're seeing them time and time again should convince us that something is going on that isn't, quote, normal anymore.
All right. If you'd like to jump in the conversation here on Nature Bats Last and Progressive Radio Network, you can call us at 1-888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. And we have James from Washington. James, you're on.
James, are you still with us?
Yes. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, sorry, just have a few quick statements from the defense industry. For the safety of people, in the case of a bioterror, anthrax, a bioterror event, number one, you will be aware that this is happening because the grid will go down. And be sure to be aware that it is not just a normal power outage. It would be an entire grid going down. Seek ham radio operators who will let you know that a national event is going on, something larger than a rolling blackout. Number two, there are 10,000 radicals in America already, different type people. For their religious purposes, they like to act out part of the pouring out of the vials. And so those people exist. And that after the grid goes down, people will not know what's going on. They communicate a little bit. The vials will be poured out. That's about 10,000 people there doing that. And it would take about 72 hours for the viruses to cause, probably Mark Austin was wrong, it was more like about 200 million deaths. So there could be many survivors if you're aware of this. Those three steps are posted thoroughly on NBL, Dr. Greg McPherson's site, in the comments today. And we also do ask a question, are people aware? It seems that Mark Austin does or did work with the CIA. There is a Hollywood connection. There is such a thing. There's books and information about how the media is involved with the CIA. I'm assuming Guy has seen that, some of the evidence that was posted there today.
Yes, I did. Thank you. I didn't expect you to come on the air, but I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. I just want to make sure that those connections make it even a little bit more why I'm concerned and want to make sure that people know that they can survive. Follow those three steps. Please go to nuclearprofessionalblogspot.com if you want to see the exact survival plan, and no, there's nothing to sell, nothing, I have no books, no media, nothing to get out of this except to make people aware on the rare instance that this is a very 600-page plan. So please, all of you, be careful. If you see if the blackouts happen, you will probably know what's occurring. Thank you to both of you. Bye.
Thank you, James. We appreciate the call. We appreciate the information as well. And you're just a big ball of sunshine for us today, aren't you? Sort of consistent with the theme of the show.
Did he say? I'd love to know where the number 10,000 vials comes from. You know what that where that comes from. I'm just interested. So it was an interesting comment.
I don't know, but maybe we can track that down through the information he has provided.
Right. Okay. I don't think we have anybody on deck at the moment. Do we want to do a climate update? And then if we have callers, we can go back, Guy, or what do you want to do?
Sure. Absolutely. That'd be fine with me.
All right.
We didn't want last week's interview with Mark Austin to end, so I didn't provide an update last week. So this week's longer than usual update will begin now, and if we have a call, we'll interrupt it, and we might push some of this climate change update information to next week's show. You can find all this information within the Monster essay at the blog, GuyMcPherson.com. We briefly mentioned a potential carbon sponge last week. There is such a device currently demonstrated to sequester carbon from the atmosphere, but it comes nowhere close to sequestering as much carbon as we produce each year. And by sequester, I mean to trap so that we can then stick the carbon underground. So it comes nowhere close to sequestering or absorbing as much carbon as we produce every year, much less to drawing down atmospheric carbon dioxide to a safe level, say below 300 parts per million. This is why we mentioned the idea briefly on the show, because I don't think it has anywhere close to the kind of power we would need to create a safe climate for ourselves going into the future. Even the climatic response to greenhouse gases has been too conservative, as reported in the December 14, 2015 online issue of Nature Climate Change. Greenhouse gases have greater potential to warm the planet than has been recognized in the past. And it looks like that didn't take long. We have Javon calling from New York. Javon, are you with us?
Hey, what's up, brother? How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for calling in. What do you got?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you guys about the report that just came out that talked about how scientists have sort of screwed the pooch and sort of underestimated how much methane comes out of the Arctic in the winter. It's how that affects the climate models that are predicting all of these things. I imagine it would have a significant sort of lessening of the time before all of these sort of feedbacks and things start really kicking into high gear. I'm curious to hear what you guys have to say about it.
Yeah, that's one of the things I was going to mention on the update when we get around to it later, because that has been referenced in the Referee Journal literature. And the bottom line is that climate scientists and the science behind climate change has underestimated the proportion of methane that is released in the wintertime. So all of the models have indicated that all the methane is coming out of the Arctic in the summer when there is less ice than there is in the winter. And as it turns out, at least 50% and probably more of the methane that comes out of the Arctic is coming out of the Arctic in the wintertime. The models miss all of that, so they underestimate by half the amount of methane coming out of the Arctic Ocean. This is huge. This is a big, big deal, and it fits into the categories that we hear so frequently on this show: faster than expected, and oops, we didn't take that into account with our modeling efforts and even with our measurements.
Good
question to follow up.
Well, I mean, I've asked this before, I believe. When do you what kind of event? I mean, the general public has no idea about methane. Everything's, you know, carbon. And you don't hear anything in the mainstream media. I've never heard anything on a radio show or a mainstream television show, and I can't recall really much in mainstream print media about methane at all. So what kind of event would have to happen for methane to, you know, I guess to make the news for that mainstream people would see?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. MSNBC ran a story, I believe it was in 2007, about methane coming out of the Arctic Ocean. This is on the long essay at the blog. And so it was something we could report upon then, when it was something that would happen in the further way, and the methane is spewing out of the Arctic
I feel like you're cutting in and out. I don't know if I'm gone or you're gone. Studio, can you hear Guy or can you hear me? Okay, we lost Guy for a second, but he's back. Go ahead, Guy. Continue with your thought.
I was talking about methane, as I recall, but, you know, I have such a scattered brain that it's
a little MSNBC you mentioned.
Okay, so that's as far as we got before I was cut off. In 2007, there was a story at MSNBC, and this is mentioned in the long monster essay at the blog. So methane coming out of the Arctic Ocean was mentioned by the mainstream in 2007. But since it's gone exponential in the atmosphere, it's been largely ignored by the mainstream since then. Right now, there is a huge methane leak coming from a storage facility. Methane is natural gas, remember, CH4. It's just natural gas. So there's a huge leak coming out of a storage facility in Southern California. And it's been going on since the fall. In, I think, September, and it's made some non-mainstream media outlets. In fact, it's all over my Facebook page, right. But it has yet to appear on the mainstream news, which is curious.
And there's not necessarily a solution to fix that. That's just not like plugging a hole.
No, that's exactly right. And in fact, as nearly as I can tell, it at this point is impossible to fix. They're just going to have to let all the methane out of the storage facility escape.
Whoops. Great. And the hits keep coming.
Yes, they do. You know, they store methane, they store natural gas below ground in places that they mined or extracted oil from previously. So these are big geologic features that are capable of holding a bunch of oil or, as desired, a bunch of natural gas. So they stick these things into these geological features. Well, guess what? Southern California isn't exactly the most stable place geologically on the planet, is it? So, you know, that stuff comes out. You put it there, you think it's going to stay there, but then an earthquake comes, or there might be an earthquake so small that you don't even notice, that it doesn't even get recorded by measurement devices. And then, boom, we got a train wreck, another one.
Great. Okay, we have another call. We have Dries from Philly. Dries, you're on the air.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, yeah, Dries.
Hey, how you doing? How you doing, fellas? Happy holidays. Happy life. I'd like to thank you all again. Thank you both for all the hard work and everything. But I really had a couple of two, three things to kind of get off my chest. I had a question, but it's really not a technical question. It's more of a philosophical question. I couldn't. I've been trying to hold it in for a while, and this kind of goes back to a couple episodes ago when Guy, you and Mike were talking about Michael Mann and other professors, especially from his alma mater, which is also my alma mater, Penn State, who's offered to go on payroll to provide disinformation. In the form of climate change denial. Frank Clemente, I know you, it was one of the names that you mentioned. I don't know when, that was pretty much a bombshell for me because I actually, you know, took his social course, which is one of the best courses I've ever took, during my undergrad. And I just had to sit back and think to myself, what does that say about us as a species, as humans, when we get sold off to the highest bidder? And these are people that I looked up to, you know, Michael Mann, you know, Frank Clemente, especially Frank Clemente. You know, I looked up, I just can't wrap my head around how we treat each other as humans. And when I think about it, it actually, you know, takes me back to the, to the Carlin joke. You know, we can't even save each other. We're going to save the planet. You know, when he says that, I mean, he was dead on when he said that. I mean, but it's funny, but it's heartbreaking at the same time. So I'm still wrestling with that question, the philosophical question. Do we really care about each other? You know, do we really care? I mean, you don't have to answer that question. It's just a rhetorical question, but I just have to get it off my chest. I mean, you guys talk about this ad nauseum. You gentlemen always talk about this, you know. It's the big question. What do, you know, how are we going to behave once all these things that you've been talking about, all the stuff that's been happening with the weather, all that's been happening with the climate, we've been doing to each other. How are we going to really behave once it really hits the fan? It's already hitting the fan now. I mean, this is the one. I mean, is it really winter? is the winter take the season off? Because I mean, out here it feels like fall. Yeah. Fall standing in for winter. Sorry for venting to you guys.
No, that's all right.
You know, I continue to believe, perhaps without any cause or evidence whatsoever, that people will act like they act now, but in a more extreme sense. So the sociopaths will become even more sociopathic. The people who act with kindness will act more kindly. In the face of disaster, some people will rise to the occasion and rush into the disaster to save fellow human beings, and some people won't. And we don't have a lot of control over what other people do. It seems to me we barely have any control over what we do, given the virtual absence of free will. But at least we can think about some scenarios and think about our place in the universal play, in the planetary play, and think about what we're doing. And I suspect that would be going a step further than most people are going. I want to mention that website that the caller mentioned about 10 minutes ago. That's nukeprofessional.blogspot.com. So if you want to track the information that he was providing, it's nukeprofessional.blogspot.com. Thanks for your call, Dries. Mike, did you want to address that comment question as well?
Well, I mean, I think you hit it, right on the head there. I think everything will just be, you know, emphasized if, let's say, collapse happens. Everybody's personality, the way people react to situations, will be kind of highlighted up close and personal a little more. One, because there's an obvious panic mode. But, you know, again, I don't really concern myself too much with those, with the scenarios, because they are scenarios. And those, who knows? Stranger things have happened. So I try not to go there too often, because I think that's when I start to get a little beat down by the information and the what ifs. I think the way I balance it is I don't go there too often and think about what could possibly happen, and just try and control what's going on right now and improve my own situation and the people that I care about. So.
Well, yeah, there's a lot to be said for living here now, right? Yeah.
It's hard.
And it's almost impossible.
Yeah.
Because we have these big brains, for better and for worse, that allow us to project into the future and get worried about what's going to happen 10 minutes from now. Like, are we going to be cut off? Are we still going to be on the air? Yeah. Or 10 days from now or 10 months from now. So, of course, we do those things.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, I try to just stay well-informed and process that information, but again, not let it overwhelm me or wallow in it too long, and try and lead a life outside of, you know, the doomosphere, so to speak, because life is happening, and if you just in it all day, it's, for me, I wouldn't be able to function, and so I try and balance it with taking the information and not necessarily just then going with it and running with it and creating all these imaginary things and scenarios in my head. So,
right. You call this functioning? I just want to clarify.
It's as close as I've been in a while. Pass the tequila.
I'm going to catch up a little bit more on the climate change update. I don't think we have a caller on the line.
Okay.
For the support for the importance of streams and rivers as sources of atmospheric methane comes from a paper published in the November 2015 issue of Ecological Monographs. The headline of the write-up for the general public tells the story, quote, greenhouse gas emissions from freshwater higher than thought. I've added this tidbit to feedback number 28. Not surprisingly, the ongoing accelerating degradation to the base of the marine food web, phytoplankton, is reducing the ability of fish populations to reproduce and replenish themselves across the globe. As reported in the November 14, 2015 online issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, I've added this information to feedback number 23. National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration's 10th Annual Arctic Report Card is out as of December 15, 2015. In a surprise finding, which they cannot yet explain, the scientists discovered that green vegetation over much of the Arctic began a few years ago to turn an uncharacteristic brown. Actually, that's no surprise if you've been paying attention to soot-covered melting ice as well as albedo decline. Not surprising even to NOAA is that maximum Arctic Ocean sea ice extent occurred 15 days earlier than average at the lowest extent recorded since records began in 1979. There's much more here, too. None of it good for walruses, fish, or humans on this particular planet.
Yeah.
Ooh, the hits keep coming. I'll do one or two more, and then we're going to have to wrap. As reported in the December 16th, 2015 issue of Geophysical Research Letters, quote, in this first worldwide synthesis of in-situ and satellite-derived lake data, we find that lake summer surface water temperatures rose rapidly between 1985 and 2009. End quote. In this case, rapidly means a global mean temperature increase of slightly more than 1/3 degree Celsius per decade, and that's fast. As has been said many times recently, faster than expected. Mm. I've added this tidbit to feedback number 28. So, Mike, you want to take us out the door?
Yeah, that's a great show. Thanks for your calls this week. It's always helpful when we have callers and we can discuss and your questions. And if you haven't ever called in, give it a shot. We'll do call-in shows from now on when we can. That about wraps it up for us. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last and Progressive Radio Network. Join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. And feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show and continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern, and we'll have a strictly call-in show. We'll be pointing out the inconsistencies of Catherine Hayhoe's work. Hayhoe is a climate scientist from Texas Tech University, made famous with her appearance in the first episode of James Cameron's series, The Years of Living Dangerously. Please send us your examples of Hayhoe's malpractice. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at prn.fm or at stitcher.com and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to our guest last week, Mark Austin, for triggering this discussion, and also to Aprazin for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.